Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And special subject on today's program is multiple sclerosis. We're going to talk to a very interesting clinician who has done work on natural approaches to multiple sclerosis. This is a big problem. Hundreds of thousands of Americans suffer from multiple sclerosis. There are drugs for multiple sclerosis, but, they don't all work satisfactorily. And while we're beginning to make progress, there's a crying need for alternative approaches to help patients. I've long been involved in utilizing these approaches, so I'm very gratified to see that there's someone who's taking this on. She is Dr. Terry Walls. Dr. Walls is a professor of medicine at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine in Iowa City, Iowa. And she is involved in teaching young doctors primary care skills. But in addition, she too is a sufferer of multiple sclerosis. And it's through her experience in coping with her disease that she's come up with a fascinating paradigm. So without further ado, let's talk to Dr. Terry Walls. It's a pleasure having you on the program, Dr. Walls.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here as well.
Okay, well, give us a little background. You yourself, you're a doctor. You're schooled in traditional medicine. You practice conventional medicine out there in Iowa, yet you were confronted with a health problem. Tell us about that.
So in 2000, I started stumbling and falling. I had some weakness in my left leg and underwent a comprehensive evaluation. And at that time, on the basis of a history of optic neuritis that occurred in 1987, my new problem of left leg weakness, lesions in my spinal cord, and abnormal spinal fluid, a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis was made. I decided to get a second opinion at one of the best MS centers in the country, the Cleveland Clinic. They agreed I had MS. I started disease-modifying drugs, in this case, Copaxone. And in the next 3 years, I had just one brief episode of weakness in my right arm, so that would be considered a success. However, I'd had continued gradual steady decline. I was having a lot of problems with fatigue. It was difficult to sit up. My doctors in 2003 told me I had transitioned to secondary progressive MS.
For our listening audience, can you help them distinguish? Because, I mean, there are different subtypes of MS.
Sure.
And, you know.
Now, relapsing remitting is when you have a relapse or worsening episode. And remit is when things improve.
Right.
So you go through a period of worse and improved states. Then about half of those individuals within 10, 15 years will convert to secondary progressive, and that's the state of the disease where there's a slow, steady decline despite therapy. And that
so they relegated you to that status. They said, you know, this is just going to simply get worse. It's not going to get dramatically worse all at once, but just a slow, steady.
Slow, steady decline.
Yeah.
I took a couple courses of Tysabri, which, by the way, is an off-label indication since it's approved only for relapsing remitting MS.
And by the way, tell us a little bit about Tysabri, because it's a powerful new drug, and it was thought to provide great hope for curing patients of MS, but there's some pretty deadly side effects associated with that medication,
you know,
aren't there?
Our immune function is a very basic part of our biology. And so while we've now developed drugs that can stop certain aspects of our immune function very effectively, so you can turn off part of the immune function as it enters the brain and decrease the risk of new acute lesions or new acute episodes using Tysabri. But any time you so dramatically, effectively stop part of the immune system, you will have some very big potential side effects because the immune functions are a very basic part of all of our biologies. And certainly one of the impacts is that it will increase the risk of activating a latent virus which can have a devastating impact on the brain. In fact, after just two cycles of Tysabri, it was pulled from the market.
Hmm.
So I only got two cycles, then switched to a different kind of immune-suppressing drug. In this case, it was Cellcept. And that's the point when it looked to me like conventional medicine wasn't stopping my disease. I was having difficulty sitting up. I could walk short distances.
So it's not as if you were averse to conventional medicine. You really had a lot of buy-in because as a physician, you understood the medical paradigm and you said, well, these drugs are plausible because they'll shut down the immune system and that should work, but they didn't really pay off for you.
Correct. I went to the best people in the country, got the latest, newest drugs, and continued to steadily decline. And at that point, I decided I needed to take more responsibility. I should start reading the literature myself and see, was there anything else that I might be able to add or do? So in 2004, I started reading the medical literature, gradually I started going to reading the animal science, animal models for MS, and then animal models for Parkinson's and dementia, Huntington's disease, ALS. And in that discovery phase, I saw a common theme that mitochondria were sending signals to the brain cells that it was time to die. And that was part of why, in all those diseases, the brains shrank.
Well, for our listening audience, and many have been very sophisticated, but for those who need a definition of mitochondria, what are they and why should they be important for the brain or in MS?
So they are the little engines that convert the food you and I eat into the energy that our cells will use. So, you know, about 1.5 billion years ago, the cyanobacteria were creating oxygen in the environment. And that is actually quite poisonous. And so about 90% of the bacteria died. One of the bacteria that survived learned how to use this new poison, oxygen, to metabolize and create energy more effectively from sugars. Those little tiny bacteria were engulfed by bigger bacteria, and these little bacteria made energy for the big bacteria.
So in effect, we can think of the mitochondria as being like little tiny proto-bacteria that had a mutation 3 billion years ago or something, and they made a pact with what were pre-animal cells to survive.
Exactly. And so those cells, because now they were very efficient, became multicellular, became animal cells, and then became mammals, and then, you know, became primates and became us. All of our cells in our body have mitochondria in them that help run the chemistry in our bodies and help us convert food into usable energy for the cell. Our brains are very, very dependent on mitochondria. And so when the mitochondria were not working well, they have too many toxic byproducts or free radicals, and that tells the brain cell it's time to die. And so then you have shrinkage of the brain, shrinkage of the spinal cord. I then turned to trying to find research articles that showed these little mouse brains and mitochondria then protected. And I was able to find some studies that various vitamins and supplements were helpful. And I translated those little animal mouse doses into human-sized doses and began my first rounds of self-experimentation. And what I was able to do is I was able to slow the speed of my decline so that things were flattened out a bit. You know, and I was really very, very grateful. But I was still declining slowly. By the summer of 2007.
But, so by the way, what were some of the nutrients that attracted your attention in those days?
So things like creatine, B vitamins, coenzyme Q, and fish oil.
Right, coenzyme Q10 being also referred to as ubiquinone or ubiquinol, and this is because the mitochondria are ubiquitous. They're everywhere, and especially in the brain.
Yes, yes. And so, you know, that was helpful, and it seemed to slow down my decline. Then in the summer of 2007, I had a couple more big discoveries. One was electrical stimulation of muscle. I discovered that while I was reviewing a research protocol, because I'm on the institutional review board for the university and review research protocols every month in terms of safety monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really pretty interesting. They were using electrical stimulation of muscles in people who had a acute injury to the spinal cord, and they wanted to extend the research protocol 5 more years because people didn't want to quit. So I thought, well, that sounds interesting. And
Yes, usually after an experiment, people just take their money and they're very happy to go.
So I looked online using PubMed and searched for eSTEM, found 212 articles, and so I read them. Most of them were in athletes. There were a few articles in cerebral palsy, children who had been helped, and a few articles in stroke people, even people who had been 5 years after the stroke, who had been greatly helped by using eSTEM. So then I made an appointment with my physical therapist, printed out those cerebral palsy and stroke articles, and made the case that I wanted to try this. And he said, well, you know, we use this for athletes. It's painful. It's exhausting. You have a lot of issues with fatigue. You have a lot of issues with MS pain. We could probably grow muscles, but I'm not sure your brain could talk to them. But it's possible if we grew more muscle in my leg, but my brain couldn't talk to that muscle because of the blocks in the spinal cord, then it would be making it harder to walk.
Hmm.
But he agreed to let me have a test session. He was right. It hurt a lot. But I felt actually exhilarated afterwards, probably because of the endorphins.
Right. After a pain, your body releases protective endorphins.
And so for a couple weeks in clinic, I did this, and I seemed to tolerate it well. And then we got a device, and so I, in addition to doing it in clinic, I began training at home. So I started the eSTEM and had an exercise program. In addition, at the same time period, I discovered an organization called the Institute for Functional Medicine and ordered a course they had, Neuroprotection, a Functional Medicine Approach for Common and Uncommon Neurologic Syndromes. And this really deepened my understanding of brain biology and some of the things that I could do. So now I had a longer list of nutrients that I should be taking for my brain. I added some supplements. And then I'll tell you, at the end of December, I had what I think was really the most brilliant idea was I should take this long list of supplements and figure out where they were in the food supply. And so, again, there was more research on the Internet. I got this figured out, reorganized my food supply. And that's really when the magic began to happen, and my strength began improving more rapidly. My brain fog went away. My energy improved. And within the year, I'm walking throughout the hospital without a cane.
Well, this is after you'd transitioned to a tilt-recline wheelchair because of weakness after your failed chemotherapy.
Correct. So I'd been in a tilt-recline wheelchair. I had a recliner because I couldn't sit up anymore, so I was either working in a recliner or I'm laying down. A year after doing my eSTEM, my new designed food plan diet, I am walking throughout the hospital, and I'm able to do an 18-mile bike ride with my family.
Goodness gracious, there's not a lot of our listeners who are in perfect shape who can do that.
The next year, I do a trail ride, and the next year, I have a study protocol written, approved, and I've written a grant for $100,000 so we can start doing the clinical trial, testing my protocol in others.
Fabulous.
With progressive MS.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'd also tell you that this experience has changed how I think about disease and health, and that I am now focused on creating health through diet, lifestyle, and I find it to be very effective for primary care kinds of problems like diabetes,
right.
Heart disease.
And this is after how many years practicing conventional medicine? It seems like you've undergone a paradigm shift in mid-career.
A big paradigm shift. You know, you said it had been 20 years of conventional medicine. And, you know, I still do conventional medicine. I still write prescriptions. But now I have a second layer where I analyze people's lifestyle factors that contribute to their disease and help them create a plan to shift those lifestyle factors to health-promoting factors.
So incidentally,
it's really very exciting results.
Yes, very exciting. And incidentally, you have a book that is just coming out or has come out. It's the Terry Walls Protocol.
Yeah, it's the Walls Protocol.
How
I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles in Functional Medicine. So I tell my personal story, which I think is, you know, of course, quite dramatic. And then I walk people through what are the lifestyle changes that I have people adopt. I give very clear instructions on how to ease your diet from whatever you're eating now to progressively healthier and healthier dietary choices. We talk about supplements. We talk about exercise, talk about e-stim, stress management, sleep. And I also give people insights from other Walls warriors who have made these changes and experienced their own remarkable healing transformations.
Well, that's great you're getting the word out. So tell us about the diet. The diet, first of all, two things will be happening. You'll be incorporating more nutrient-dense foods providing the essential nutrients. But at the same time, you made some eliminations. So which do you think is more profound, or can you separate out those two things?
I think they're both very important. Many, many people have unrecognized food sensitivities that really overactivate the immune system and create harmful levels of inflammation. And I'm certainly one of them. And then the vast, vast majority of Americans are in a deep pit of inadequate nutrition with inadequate levels of minerals, essential fats, vitamins, and many antioxidants. Most of our food is very rich in calories, sugars, and carbohydrates, but we have very few vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, or essential fats. So, you know, I stress 9 cups of fruits and vegetables in a very specific way to make sure you have the nutrients that I'm wanting you to have.
With an emphasis on the beneficial polyphenols, probably a lot of berries in that formula.
Exactly. So we have a lot of green leaves, mm-hmm. a lot of foods from the cabbage family, onion family, mushroom family, and a lot of things that are brightly pigmented all the way through. So I call that the green sulfur color. So you have 3 cups from each group.
Mm-hmm.
Then we want high-quality protein.
And by that you mean, you know, some people, you know, this, of course, you're aware that there was a predecessor diet for MS, the so-called Swank diet, which emphasized, it was a quasi-vegetarian diet. You, however, have discovered that a paleo diet that contains ample amounts of animal protein works as well, or do you think better?
Much superior. So I designed my diet based on my view of the literature of what are the 31 nutrients that science says our brains need for optimal function. And then I go to where in the food supply that I could obtain here in the middle of the U.S. That would provide those 31 nutrients. And how do I organize that food plan so I could teach others so they would know how to eat to make sure they had those 31 nutrients?
Right. So it's important to communicate this information, not just be an N of one study and then write some obscure medical treatise on it that a lot of doctors will read and then ignore.
Correct. And, you know, and frankly, that's part of why, I'm very grateful to have my life back. Had I not discovered this, I'm sure I would be bedridden by now and probably have very serious cognitive decline.
So you want to give back?
So I'm giving back. So since 2009, I've been giving lectures to the community and to health professionals a couple times a week around the country and internationally. I made the TED Talk that had a 1.5 million views.
Right. That's actually a very prestigious accolade for someone who seems to be dabbling in what they would term alternative medicine. They have a little bit of a, an attitude towards doctors who profess benefits from vitamins and supplements and, you know, these natural cures. And yet you manage to breach that barrier and give a very, very mainstream talk to TED, which is great. I viewed it, and it's very inspirational.
You know, and it tells the story very succinctly, just the food portion. You know, it leaves out the meditation, exercise, e-stim, but you only have 18 minutes, so I had to pick
right.
this, you know, one part of my protocol. But, you know, I've been working very hard at getting this information out, both to my health professional colleagues and directly to the public, and to give the public the chance to say, okay, you can wait for clinical practice to change if you want. But if you want to try some relatively minimal risk interventions that are completely under your control, that have a chance to dramatically improve your health, here are some things that you can do. I explain the science behind it. I explain how to do it in a very practical, step-by-step fashion. And then invite people to talk to their family, talk to their doc, and see what happens.
So tell us a little bit about the paleo diet. It's quite popular these days. And what might be the rationale for using a paleo diet in an autoimmune disease?
So the paleo diet is based on a diet that hunter-gatherers, traditional societies would follow. And we have folks, and that really is adapted over thousands of generations to each locale, and it's highly adapted to each locale. For example, the Inuit in the far north eat animal products that have been fermented or allowed to rot for 10 months out of the year, and 2 months out of the year, there'll be some plant material in it. Yeah, other hunter-gatherer societies have a wider mix of plant and animal material. That's a bit more balanced. Many societies have a lot of worms, grubs, insects, because they're very high in fat content.
You're not necessarily recommending those to MS sufferers, however.
Well, what I am recommending, no, I'm not recommending.
Worms and grubs.
Worms and grubs. Although I am acknowledging that all of these societies, what they have in common is they have very different foodstuffs and a very different mix of protein, fat, carbohydrate content. But what they all have in common is they a dramatic nutrient density that exceeds 2 to 10-fold the RDAs compared to the American diet.
So it's the opposite of empty calories.
The absolute
opposite. Is a nutrient-dense food. So the opposite of, say, a fried donut would be, one of your berry-rich concoctions or, a fish that's rich in omega-3 fatty acids and all the, iron and vitamins and minerals.
Now, what I have done that's a little different from, most of our modern-day primal paleo plan, say the Rob Wolf paleo plan or primal by Mark Sisson, they tell people to eat vegetables, fruit, meat. But they don't put necessarily a lot of structure into which vegetables and which fruits you provide.
Right.
If you analyze their diets, though, they certainly have far more nutrient density than the standard American diet. But they don't perform as well as the hunter-gatherers who are still eating wild foods. And part of that is because wild foods have far more vitamin, mineral, antioxidant content because they haven't been bred to have more carbohydrate for maximal production per acre.
So those glorious giant strawberries that you get in the supermarket up here in Minnesota in January, they're not the real deal.
Yeah, that's right. They won't be as nutrient dense as a wild strawberry. Now, what I did, because I really needed to maximize my nutrient density, I organized my food so that I was chasing nutrient density to get those 31 nutrients, magic nutrients. And that's why I have the greens, the sulfur, and the color organized the way I do. That's why I say, grass-fed meat, wild fish, and organ meat, and seaweed. So that when we analyze, a week of our menus, we perform just like the traditional hunter-gatherer societies, that our nutrient density, depending on the nutrient, is 1.5 to 9 times the RDAs. Just like our traditional hunter-gatherer societies. So we're performing better than the other paleo and primal diets because we provide more structure.
Mm-hmm.
So people know precisely which foods to eat to maximize your nutrient density. Because we don't have our great ancestors that were still following traditional hunter-gatherer diets. So I used research to tell me which nutrients to maximize. I maximized those. We did our nutritional analysis. We confirmed that we're able to do that. And then the results I see in my clinic, people look steadily younger, more healthy, more vital.
And this could be patients without MS, patients with perhaps, insulin resistance, prediabetes.
Absolutely.
Virtually anyone can benefit from this.
Absolutely. If you're healthy and you want to look younger, eat this way. If you have a mood problem, you want your moods to even out, eat this way.
Right.
If you got a weight problem, you'd like to lose weight without being hungry, eat this way. If you have an autoimmune problem and you'd like to feel healthier and need fewer meds, eat this way.
Is this a grain-free diet?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, so I have three levels to the diet.
Okay.
So the first level, we're stressing the 9 cups. We're limiting grains and starches that are gluten-free to 1 serving a day. On the paleo diet, we take grain away. on the Paleo Plus diet. I add more fat and make this more of a ketogenic type diet.
Okay, so it's according to people's characteristics, if they're overweight or if they are have a very serious autoimmune disease or if they just want to get some of the benefits of this, then they can find their level.
Correct. We give people information about why they might choose whichever level, and I give some encouragement to which level I think might be best for them. But in the end, I invite people to progress through the Walls Paleo, the Walls Paleo Plus, plans at the pace that they and their family are willing to go. You know, and I also note, this really, people are most successful if we do this as a family. So it's a family conversation. What are we willing to do as a family to change how we eat and live? And because if you have one diet for one person and a different diet for everyone else, it's generally not sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need a community social support to make it work. I'm interested in that you initially you got introduced to this via functional medicine, which takes the approach that you take a whole battery of supplements, and then later you recognize the primacy of diet. But did this lead you to abandon the use of supplements, or do you continue to support the use of supplements for patients with MS?
And I talk about this in my book, which supplements you may want to consider and why, and give people a rationale for how they would approach supplements, how to introduce them, monitor them, and determine if they're helping you or not. So supplements may be very beneficial. But food is the most critical. You get the food wrong. There's no supplement that will dig you out of a lack of the right food.
Well, I think that's a very important message to convey because there are so many people who are all too willing to pop a lot of pills, but when it comes to making substantial diet changes, they don't want that to crimp their style.
Well, they're addicted. They're addicted to foods that are harmful, and it's very difficult for them to let go of that addiction.
And so clearly, we need to emphasize diet more. And, and I find, clinics that just push pills these days, their results are less profound than clinics that really insist on a fundamental realignment of people's diets, as inconvenient as it might be. You know, some people say, well, you know, when can I get off this darn diet and go back to my ways because I'm feeling better? And the answer is, maybe you should think about it as a long-term commitment.
It's a lifetime. It's how you live now.
Absolutely. So when it comes to supplements, which are some of the supplements that stand out, in your opinion, to support patients with MS? You mentioned creatine, B vitamins, coenzyme Q10, omega-3 fish oil.
Fish oil. So, that's where I would start. You'd also want to know what your vitamin D level is.
Yes, and that many studies are showing that's important,
very
too.
Very important to optimize that. And then, depending on the circumstances, the individual history, risk factors, additional supplements may be very useful.
Right.
But that tends to be personalized. I am very careful. In the public health message, I have a smaller supplement list. And then I have a longer conversation in the book about other potential benefits and who might benefit in things to think about in terms of the additional things that you may want to consider. But you want to do that in a stepwise, sequential fashion.
Right. Okay, and you detail all of this in your book, The Walls Protocol, How I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles in Functional Medicine. And this book has actually made quite a stir. It's you might think, well, it's a little off the beaten track, but actually Dr. Walls is making a big impact because the MS community is paying attention, and lots of people with challenging medical conditions are beginning to look to this type of dietary approach and lifestyle modification as a way of treating things.
Yes. And this is helpful for many, many types of autoimmune conditions. It's not just MS.
Which others, for example?
Well, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, psoriatic arthritis, and chronic health problems like diabetes, obesity, heart disease, atherosclerosis, high blood pressure.
So I have a question for you, and you know, from I'm talking doctor to doctor here. Today I spoke to the parents of a child who I've been treating with a similar type of nutritional protocol for an autoimmune disease, autoimmune hepatitis. And she has dramatically improved. And the question is, can she go off her immune suppressive medication? She's taking a medication called Imuran. The doctors have said, and are really intimidating the parents, saying that no way, no how can nutrition have an impact on a condition like this. Don't be deceived by the charlatans. This is a child who needs to remain on immunosuppressive medication for the rest of her life. I've seen, however, patients with autoimmune hepatitis and many patients with other autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, improve and ultimately wean off medication, MS as well. So what do you do with this entrenched attitude in the medical community? I mean, how do you as a physician, you know, you must be shunned by some of your colleagues.
Well, yeah, since I do research and every year, twice a year, we get to put up my research posters and the community, they come by, look at our results and they go, man, that's amazing. I understand you have some frozen blood. Could I, so people are joining my research team because they would like to analyze, our frozen blood because we have such, exciting results. Now, in my clinical practice, as people improve and their biomarkers improve, so their, CRP, C-reactive protein improves, their homocysteine improves, lipids improve, fasting insulin levels improve, blood pressure improves, then we can begin to take those medications for those conditions down. In the question of chronic immune suppression, if their health has returned so that there is no evidence for active inflammation as measured by whatever biomarker that you have for that disease, then you can begin to have that conversation. Now, ideally, you find a allergy, a treating physician who's there willing to work with you on that. I certainly have seen our subspecialists get more and more comfortable with recognizing that nutrition is decreasing disease activity and that we can consider lowering the immune suppression. If one does that, I would do it gradually. And
because you don't want a setback because you got one bite at the apple, and if there is a relapse, then you know the conventional doctors will feel vindicated, and they'll just say, "Look, that was just a folly. You know, you shouldn't have gone there, and just you know go back. You know, eat whatever you like, and go back to a regular medical approach."
So my advice is, get all of your biomarkers that indicate health back, showing that the person does have little inflammation and robust health. Then working with their treating physician to gradually begin to diminish the immune suppression and see what happens. Do this very slowly and continue to watch carefully. And that may require a certain amount of assertiveness on the patient's part saying, you know, I've read the side effect profile of these immune suppression drugs. I am more comfortable with weaning them off and seeing how my daughter, my child, or I do going off than taking the continued risk of the immune suppression. And our patients often forget that in the end they have to consent and they get to decide which risk they would rather endure. The risk of immune suppression, and they invite them to read the package insert on the immune suppression drugs, or the risk of very slowly, gently weaning away the immune suppression drugs and watching closely.
While safely monitoring and making sure that, you know, it's not just wishful thinking.
Stays quiet.
No, I totally concur with you, and that's the approach that we took with this young lady. Although, you know, there's sort of a schism in medicine, and that creates a lot of confusion and trepidation for patients. So, you know, I really commend you for your work and for an effort to mainstream what seems esoteric, but you're taking a very scientific approach. You're doing studies. You're documenting very carefully what you're doing. There's a scientific rationale for it that you explain. I want to ask you one other question that may be a little bit of a curveball, but a lot of patients in the MS community are utilizing low-dose naltrexone.
Oh, sure.
Is that something that's part of your protocol?
It is not part of my protocol. I did try that and found it to have no impact for me.
Okay.
I do know that there certainly are many reports that it has been helpful. It's a relatively non-toxic thing to try.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's I utilize it in patients with MS. I think it is something that it's not a home run or a miracle for every patient, but it may be a gentle immune modulator that patients can go on once they've weaned off conventional medications as sort of a remission maintenance mechanism along with all the natural things that mm-hmm. you're suggesting.
Yeah.
So, well, fantastic. The book again, The Walls Protocol. You have a website at TerryWalls.com. It's WAHLS, TerryWalls.com. And, well, thank you very much for joining us, and I commend you for your careful work, and also want to congratulate you on your personal success in turning the corner on a very debilitating disease.
Well, let me also pitch, when people come to my website, do sign up for the newsletter.
Yes.
There's a lot of great information there. We have lots of free content to help people learn about food and lifestyle and learn how they can begin the first steps.
Is the TED seminar posted there, by the way?
It is. What they have to do is give us the email address, then they can get into the community resources page. And we have testimonials where they'll see hundreds of other people's stories, how they've gotten better, recipes, and videos. And a bunch of articles. So great resources there.
Well, thank you very much for being in the vanguard of this very, very important movement and helping a lot of patients with MS and other challenging medical conditions. Dr. Terry Walls. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.